percent of heavy load. So
I just use like time.net stuff.
Yeah. So where is everybody? Is there something going on or? Remember you ran over to the registrar and dropped?
It's related to that.
Yeah.
Depends on how hard you beg, right?
91W.
Okay, so any questions on file systems so far? I'd turn up the heat if I could, it's cold.
No.
Alright, so you asked about extents, and I want to actually try to get to that thing, because at least indirectly. Yeah, the idea that you could organize the file as sort of sequential blocks, that sequential units that might be larger than a block. And usually when people talk about extents, very often the units that they're talking about are larger, but those larger units are all uniform in size. Part of the reason you want uniformity is, hey, to bring that data in from the disk, I have to have a cache to put it in. Cache management is much, much simpler if the elements of my cache all have the same size. So if I'm going to deal with a block size and an extent size, still at least it's only two sizes.
Yeah.
So talking about how placement of data is important and how the criteria for optimizing for write are quite a bit different from the criteria for optimizing for reading. If you're optimizing for write, your job is get the data off my hands. And if you're optimizing for reading, the job is lay the data down nicely so I can get it back later. And the object demographics graph would tell you why it might be okay to optimize for write. Young objects are probably never going to get rid of the file system at all before they get deleted. At most, they'll go to the swap area. Right? And the swap area gives you this nice co-location property that the file system, being much larger, can't give you. So, before I go past it, I just want to point out that while it was historically customary for file systems to sit on disk drives or on DOS systems to sit on partitions, nowadays we have what are called logical volume managers. So what a logical volume manager does is it takes potentially several disks and it conceptually gathers them together and then presents upwards the illusion of a single disk whose storage is basically gathered from those individual disks. And it's not a complex organization. It takes, so if you use LVM on Linux, which is a pretty typical one of these for everyday systems, what you'll see is that the logical volume manager says, look, I'm willing to talk to disks in units of 64 megabytes at a pop. Okay? So the rule is, you make a partition, you want to get full use of it, it's got to be a multiple of 64 megabytes. If there's like a fractional part in the end, forget it, I'm not going to use it. And it then presents upwards a logical disk that under the covers is a sequence of 64 megabyte chunks. And it just maintains an offset table. So for each of these 64 megabytes, or it can even be bigger, it just keeps an offset table that says, okay, if you're looking here, it went to that disk, that partition, and this chunk. And usually it actually keeps the chunks in order. So really, this table is actually very short because the first 30 chunks came from one disk, and the next 60 chunks came from the second disk, but they're all sort of left in their original order. So all it's going to do is a linear walk through this table. It's just doing an offset and disk computation. Now, in the case of LVM, LVM also supplies two other pieces of function that are widely used and popular. One is called mirroring. So the idea of mirroring is I have two identical disk drives or partitions. And what I'm going to do is, here's my operating system that's looking down at this. Right? I'm going to present the illusion of a single drive. Any write that goes to that drive is actually going to get written to both drives. I'm not going to report that it's done until it's down on both drives. Any read that's requested from that watch provider, time comes to the read, I'm going to look downwards and say, okay, which drive is likely to get there first? That's the one I'll put the read to. Right, so I get a speed up. But if that read should fail, I will attempt to recover by reading from the second drive. And if the second drive is able to deliver the block, I will then rewrite it to the first drive. Right, so basically I'm replicating the storage here for the sake of robustness, performance, by redundancy. Nowadays, with this being fairly large and fairly cheap, this is probably the better technology to use, but there's another technology. And so this is called mirroring. You'll also see it sometimes called RAID 1, but you should be aware that... You should be aware that the adoption of the term RAID 1 for this was a piece of marketing garbage. Right? The correct term for this is mirroring. In fact, the RAID people would like to brand it as RAID. There's not a reason to call it RAID. But the second technique says, if I have more than two drives, doesn't matter what number, any number larger than two will suffice. I can do better than mirroring. I can get better utilization, and I can still get recoverability. So here's the trick. And this is why the chunk size, the extent size in the logical volume measures is where this is going to come into play. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write half the data to one disk, half the data to the second disk, I'm going to write a parity check to the third disk. Now, what this means is if I have any two pieces of the three, or if I have k drives, as long as I'm able to recover k minus one pieces, I'll be able to reconstruct the data. In effect, what's happening is I'm using drives to implement something called an error correcting code. So what I've done by striking the data across multiple drives this way is I've provided a guard against any single drive failure. As long as k drives survive. Much cheaper in terms of the cost of drives than mirroring, because customarily this is done on like four or five drives at a time, so you get much, much higher utilization. The overhead of mirroring is 100%. Right? Because it's twice as much as I needed, right? Every one storage I had, I need that much again. It's 100% overhead. My old phone, you'd hit the end button and it would say, no, I'll pick up the voices. The new phone, you hit the end button, it doesn't do anything. It's a different button you have to push, so all your training is stale. So, customarily, when people do the second configuration, they'll use four or five drives. So, if I'm using four drives, right, then here's k drives, okay, of which k minus one are significant. So if I have three drives, I need one more, so the overhead of this is only 33%. I need a third, whatever volume of data I have, if I'm doing four-way RAID, I need 33% more. Or if I have k content drives, I need one over k additional storage.
But there must be a limit to the amount of...
Yes, I get a 99 drives. The number of spare drives, number of additional drives, I get spare drives in a second. That determines how many drive failures I can recover from. I can compute parity over an arbitrary number of drives. Now, if I want to recover from more than one drive failure, which is feasible, although I don't know that anybody's done it in production systems. It's done in memory systems commonly. Okay. If I wanted to be able to recover from two drives worth of failure, then I need a minimum of three additional drives. Right? That'll allow me to repair two failures. And there's a rule, there's a particular exponential equation for how you compute these error-corrected codes so that you can recover, not only know that you lost the data, but also which data you lost and how to recover. In fact, I think if you use 3 bits of correction, there's a relationship between the number of bits of correction and the number of bits of data. So if you think of each drive as offering a bit, I can give you an equation, I'd have to go look it up again, I need to know how it works. It will tell you how many bits of data you have, and how many of those bits you want to allow to fail and still be recoverable. And I can tell you how many extra bits of correction data you need. And you can apply those same rules to rate design. If you hear people talk about rating without any kind of a qualifying number, they're talking about this one. Okay? But officially, this is known as RAID 5. And in theory, this version of RAID will also get you good throughput, although in practice it often does not. The difference is this. In the mirroring design, I can send the heads to independent locations, and so I can have multiple reads that I'm satisfying at the same time, and the heads can operate independently unless there's one of those rare failures. So the normal operating mode is I'm really doing reads independently, it's the writes that are coordinated. In RAID 5, all of the drives have to respond to every read request. Now, strictly speaking, I can exploit the parity in a different way, and I can issue my reads to 3 out of 4 in this scenario, because I can reconstruct, given the main 3 out of 4. That's actually not enough for me to get useful parallelism out of the drives. No matter what I do, 3 of these drives are committed for every item. So, long linear blocks of data, this will do really, really well because I can spread the data motion across 3 drives. The bottleneck on the drives is rotation and bus feedback to me, and I am tripling that. I can, in fact, get that out of mirroring too, if that's my access pattern. Here's the difference. On RAID 5, those heads have to move pretty much in lockstep. When you do a little bit of caching, but not a lot, because you're doing big IOs. The reason you're doing big IOs is because it's not profitable to compute checksums on small IOs. Correct me, folks. And let me see in 1 second. And more importantly, when I do writes, all the drives are involved. And writes are really expensive, because here's what really happens. I have this 64 megabyte extent on the drive. I write 4 kilobytes. I got to recompute checksum or the CRC for the entire 64 megabytes. So in order to write that 4 kilobytes, I have to pick the extent up, bring in the cache in the RAID controller, change the 4 kilobytes to the 8 kilobytes or whatever write I did, compute the effect on the CRC, and rewrite the blocks that changed, including the checksum block. So I end up doing a read before every write in practice. Because if you think about it, the number of times that you do a 64 megabyte write, I mean, how often does it happen? Databases? Sure, all the time. Real world? If your laptop writes 64 megabytes this week, you know, barring doing some kind of FTP transfer from someplace, if your laptop writes 64 megabytes this week, it was a strenuous week. And the performance difference here is really impressive, right? It's a factor of 5 slower than mirroring in practice. That's what we're seeing in the lab. We had a machine that was configured this way. It was so horribly slow, we bought more drives and turned this off and went to mirroring. Yes?
Is that with dedicated RAID hardware?
It's the IO that's limited. It's not the RAID hardware. All right? The people who sell RAID cards would like you to believe that this is a hardware problem. It's nonsense. It was a hardware, so it's a hardware problem when you get a very, very large system. Right? Then offloading the load matters. It used to be a hardware problem in the i386 and the i486. The processor is simply in the processing capacity to do this with any kind of speed. These are not the limiting factors of current generation systems. All the way up to the high-end mid-range servers, not the limiting factor. The issue here is IO. Those disks, they're not spinning any faster. So people who configure this stuff in production, right, they're configuring them with these ultra-high-speed SCSI drives. You know what you pay to get high-speed SCSI drives? Smaller storage capacity. The way those things get faster, when you get faster seat times, is you make the drive smaller. And I don't mean just smaller in terms of geometry, I mean smaller in terms of less capacity. If you want to go buy an ultra-high-speed drive today, what you'll discover is it comes in units of 40 gigabytes, maybe 60. The stuff you buy over the counter on the high-end of CompUSA is 500. And what's going on is the need for speed on that data is so high, right, that I'm willing to pay several multiples, right, to get speed out of this configuration because I needed the reliability. Do you have a pending question?
Oh,
it was my favorite. Okay. And by the way, if you mirror, that speed is actually mostly non-motivated. Yeah.
What do you consider ultra-high speed?
Generally speaking, you have two metrics. You have rotation speed and you have seat times, right? So the fastest drives, the last time I looked, and this was a year or two ago, were the 10,000 RPM drives.
And
they have 15,000 RPM drives. Okay, so there's some, okay, apparently there's some that are faster. And at the time that I looked, the sort of commodity seat times were in the 9 to 11 millisecond range, and the high speed drives had seat times in the 4.5 millisecond.
Is there a simple answer why there's no 10K RPM IDE drive?
There are 10K RPM IDE drives.
I've never seen them. I've only seen SCSI.
You can buy them. Go down to CompUSA. They're on the stock right now. There may be SATA rather than IDE because SATA is incrementally replaceable. But they're out there. They're not universal. I mean, they're not there all the time because they go out of stock, right? But they have them periodically. And nobody wants them because it's just not, for commodity purposes, it's not going to help. And if you're serious about large-scale data management, you're not buying these DKIE drives, right? Although that you can see, it turns out that IDE drives now have as much smarts and as much capacity as SCSI, and SCSI is slowly dying. The only real reason you buy SCSI now is there's sort of this legacy artifact that these external storage systems want to talk SCSI because that's what they were originally designed to. But a modern IDE RAID card does very, very well. Now the problem, second problem with the striping RAID, with parent, K-minus one RAID, right? So what happens if your controller blows its top is you can't boot. Because the knowledge of what the configuration was of these drives and how the striping was done, that knowledge is buried in a static RAM on your controller board. Now, usually when they initialize the drives, when they initialize what's called the array, they'll write a header saying, here's how I configured the array. You fry your controller, and if you go out and buy a compatible controller from the same vendor, chances are good the compatible controller can go out and try to figure out what went wrong. If you got to go buy a third-party controller, like you bought, you know, a four card, or no, not four, three-wear card, right? And, you know, hey, three-wear has been around a lot. There's several generations of cards. You buy a newer card, I've never had occasion to test this. I'm not 100% convinced the newer card knows how to read the formatting laid down by the older card. With the mirroring thing, I've seen cases where mirrors go out of sync. And the case that's really bad is when that happens on your slash boot partition. Because there was a window of time when Fedora didn't know how to recover from that. But at least it's the case that if you yank one of these drives, the surviving drive looks like a perfectly ordinary normal drive. It can be booted in a normal disk system, even if one that's completely unaware that the RAID or mirroring is going on. So in our lab, for reasons of performance, we gave up on the array idea, right? And we've got a machine down there that's got about 2 terabytes in useful storage, maybe it's about 1.5. And what that means is it's got 3 terabytes of disk sitting in the drive of the machine, right? It occupies about that much space in the rack. It's just not that big, right? So the drive is not one of the factors. In a large machine room, you have heat problems. He's a serious one. But it's not a problem at the scale of one machine. Even in our closet, though, we've only got four machines in the closet. We've got dedicated air conditioning in that closet. Because in the summer, we kill the machines. Right? We melt them, literally. There's a great website you can go to that shows what happens if you run an AMD versus, well, particular generation of AMD versus Pentium processor, if you take the cooling fan off of the processor.
Right?
Well, you take the heat sink off the processor. What?
Did you see it like melted through
the board? Yeah, one of them actually melts through the board. Okay. The other one just slows down. Okay. And you know, it's one of these like, if I were the marketing guy on the wrong side of that demo, I'd be thinking, oh no. You know? And it's not like anybody's gonna do that, okay? It's just, but it's great video. Yeah, it's pretty close. Okay, so let me go back. I wanted to hit on that just so you saw it, and I wanted to get the idea of the volume manager across. I'm going to come back to a related idea later, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But let me pose a hopefully thought-provoking question. Actually, how many of you went out and looked at the power manager? What'd you find out? Okay.
They have a lot about the one I looked at was mostly graphical stuff, like what's the turnaround KDE or no.
Okay. Right. So and I should have said yeah.
Well, the one thing I found was the CPU frequency stuff.
Right.
So the flushing, you turn down your brightness and CPU
frequency stuff. Right. So disk flush, backlight on your panel, processor speed. And actually, nowadays, if you install later versions of Fedora, Fedora 4 had it, Fedora 5 now really has it solidly in, and most of the other Linux distributions have it solidly in, you'll get the frequency scaling stuff right out of the box. And some of the newer distributions even have a utility, and you can say, I would like to run in laptop mode now, and it will simply go around and flip all these settings for you. And you can tweak what it does, but I mean, it's sort of designed to be easy. All right, here's a thought-provoking question. So, I started with a disk that was basically, I was going to model it as a big linear space. Right? So, the disk was initially empty. And here's a sort of strange datum for you. In 1999, I was having a conversation with Peter Kapek at IBM. This was before software that would help me migrate from my old machine to my new machine became commonplace. And Peter and I were talking about building such software as a way to encourage people to purchase ThinkPads. I was working at IBM, buying ThinkPads to support them, trying to help the ThinkPad division. They were in trouble. You may have noticed that they got sold. They now work for a champion. That's really weird. Lenovo still sends promos out to IBM shareholders. I don't know why. So we wanted to migrate data from the old machine to the new machine, and one of the inevitable questions is, well, just how much data are we talking about? I mean, because you're imagining you're going to do this over like a parallel keyboard or something lame like that. Because people don't have, a lot of people don't have network controllers. Now. Then you have a cable box or a DSL box, right, that is set up for one machine. The answer is, well, on average, if you sell some new machine, you go and you look at the timing of the machine, how much the disk is utilized, it's under 20%. How much is the basic disk? Well, and of that 20%, the depressing amount of it is Windows. Almost none of it is user data. No joke. How much of that data, what percentage of the new drive is made up? Basically, how much is the drive technology advanced such that at the price point the user is replacing at, you know, presumably I have more disk capacity because disks get better over time. So how much of the new disk will I eat storing everything on the old disk? Answer, under 1%. Conclusion, never delete anything. It's not worth it. Right? The search engine is getting faster than you can delete data. Now, if you're a serious data hoarder like I am, because I have copies of every operating system, every public operating system known to man, this may not be true for you. It certainly is not true for me. But for most users, it's basically right, that the disk isn't going to get full. Yes, and it sounds counterintuitive, but then how fast is your dad type? Or your mom? But even if it is tensible, I mean, let's just sort of play this out. So we went and we set up this fairly complicated story for how we were going to organize data on the disk with this indirection stuff, and then we said, Nick, this indirection stuff is a big pain in the neck. Well, why are we doing it? Here's an alternative way we lay out data on the disk. Suppose we just said, look, you know, I'm going to have my inodes, although I'm going to cheat on those in a minute, but let me start out with four. And I'm just going to start at the bottom of the disk, okay, and I'm going to write. When I'm done with that file, I'm going to write. When I'm done with that file, I'm going to write. Why shouldn't I organize the disk this way?
Because what if you want to resize that first file to make it a little bit bigger?
So I'll copy. I want to resize the file? Good. I'll take the file away. I'll move it up here. Or I'll divide in the chunk, but let's start with copy. Why shouldn't I do that? They're beautifully linear. I don't need any fancy data structure, man. They're completely linear. There's no indirection table. I need to do the start and the end. I can do arithmetic for everything else. You're looking a little disturbed here. What's wrong with this picture?
You don't want to seek across the whole disk.
Why not? I'm going to seek across the whole disk anyway. In the other scheme, I'm going to spread the data across the disk anyway. And if you think about it, it's true, I'm going to seek further if I'm spreading files this way. Hey, if they get too scattered, I can just take the files at the front, right? At the back, and sort of move them to the front. If I get a hole that looks too big. But better still, even if I have to seek from the start of the file, it's only one seek, right? It's not four seeks from the data directional. Okay, why are you thinking that? What's wrong with this picture?
But if you want to write a file,
so the problem is, you're saying, you know, when I get out of here, is that what you're saying? I haven't started to, whoops. So what do I do about it?
Go to the next item.
Go to the next what?
Give it another.
Oh, this is it. This is all the drive you get. Yeah, I mean, the practical answer is yes, it's time to go buy a new drive. Because it's a lot cheaper than figuring out what to delete.
Well, compaction is bad. You don't want to have to compact.
Why is compaction bad?
Because it's extra work and it's a pause. If you're doing it right, you don't
want to. Why don't I do it in the background? Why don't I do it in the background?
You're saying, do you do it before it's necessary?
Yeah. I mean, just because those twits in Redmond, right, don't know how to background defragment a file system doesn't mean it can't be done. I mean, in their defense, doing it for VFAT is particularly unpleasant. There are good reasons not to do it in the background. It is camp error prone.
How was that?
But in principle, you know, single user system disk is idle most of the time. And ignoring battery issues, which are becoming increasingly important, so you may have noticed, sales of desktop machines are declining. Sales of laptop machines are going through the roof. The desktops are going the way of the dinosaur. Which is rough on the dinosaur, but, you know, it's really nice on my reducing my real estate problem like that. Could I do it in the background also? So think about what's going to happen over time. Right? I'm going to write a bunch of files. Okay, and then some of them are going to get deleted, so I'm going to get holes. And one sort of naive, simple thing I can do is I can say, look, at some threshold, these holes, they're getting to be a sizable percentage. And I'm looking ahead, and I don't have an infinite amount of storage in that direction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pretend that this thing is a circular buffer. So when I run off the end, I'm going to start over at the beginning. But in order to do that, I'm going to discover that there are things like this file at the beginning that's kind of orphaned back there. And to get that file out of the way, what I'm going to do is constantly move these guys to the front. Now, just to calibrate this, it's not crazy. I actually recently did a machine recovery on a machine at home, and I actually had to move about 400 gigabytes of data to a backup machine back. It took 3 days, and that was on a gigabit network. You got to move a lot of data to fill a drive. You got plenty of time to do that. So what do you think of this? I mean, you can try another idea. Yeah?
It may work just fine, it may just be slow. But for intensive I.O. operations like we were just talking about, if you're trying to copy files in and you want to copy a file that's larger than the next available gap, you have to either compact or split. And if you end up
No. I have to be moving data out of the way in advance. You're not going to compact or split this time. You might split. You're not going to compact. I'm running this move to front thing in the background all the time.
Yeah, but if you're doing intensive disk I/O, there is no background.
Yes, right, good. So if I actually manage to write 250 gigabytes to a 300 gigabyte drive, yeah, I'm going to do twice as much I/O because I'm going to be constantly moving things out of the way. Although there's an asymptotic thing going on there, right? Because if I'm going to successfully write 250 gig to a 300 gig drive, there can't be more than 50 gig on. So the worst case scenario is the drive is half full and badly fragmented. Because then I'm probably going to have to move all that data around. But if I'm running a background static, I can control that fragmented. Yes, I mean, so there's an interesting... It's not obvious. In fact, I can go one further because, you know, boy, it's a pain in the ass to design that thing is way over here at the front of the disk when I'm doing all my I.O. way down there on the other end of the drive. So what I can do instead is I can, instead of doing this file at a time, now we're going to change the story a little bit. We're going to divide this chunk of the disk into extents. Now here's the model. I always have a current extent. That's the one I'm writing to. And when I write to this extent, I write a portion of the file, and I write a trailing record telling me what's there. This is, in effect, the portion of the... In fact, what I'm really going to do, if I'm clever, I'm going to write that portion of the I/O table that describes this extent. All of it. So it's a subset of the I/O table. It's short enough to be written in a reasonable linear write. I'm just going to rewrite the whole thing. And I'm going to have an update marker that's going to tell me how far into the extent I have written. We just built a transaction system. If a write fails, that update marker doesn't get updated, and I will silently roll back to the previous update. Barring modifications to a system, to a file, I can either copy the file forward if it's small, or I can leave the file where it was, and I can go ahead and use the indirect block design with the following caveat, that I'm going to try really hard because I'm doing linear I/O, I'm very often going to get to linearize all the indirect blocks. And if I'm really careful about it, right, I'm now relying on the story now that most of my I/Os are basically contiguous, and the ones that aren't, I'm going to eventually relocate the files to fix. So it would become reasonable to do a file layout description format, which took the form starting offset, length starting block number. Right? And it should be a linear list of contiguous regions of my file. Contiguous meaning that they were written in linear fashion on the drive. So I'm not going to go for a tree structure. And my goal is, I can get that table small enough, I can do that table in one I.O. and I know where everything in that file went. And yes, sometimes I'm going to get clobbered and that table is going to get long. Mostly when I've done a lot of small updates to a file. But I can recover from that by simply moving the file to the front. I just pick it up and rewrite it. This file system never needs to run a consistency check. More precisely, the reason you run a periodic consistency check is to discover failures of this media, not failures of the I.O. system. This file system always gets to write data in linear fashion and never with ordering requirements for consistency. Because the consistency, right, the magic moment for consistency is when the pointer moves forward. This file system does not use an allocation bitmap. It uses an allocation bitmap for extents, not for files.
Is moving the pointer forward a two-step operation?
Typically, the way you move the pointer forward is you have two sets of blocks and you have a serial number. So the block contains two items. It contains an increasing serial number and it contains the block number at the end of the section. So when you reread, when you're reloading your state from this file system, when you first attach the file system, you go out and grab these two blocks, you compare the serial numbers, whichever one is later, that's the one you believe. So you're always running ping pong. The reason is you don't want to get halfway through a write on one of these blocks and drop the ball, because then you're really gone. This file system always does linear I.O. both for writing and mostly for reading. And when it can't do it for reading, if it can't do it now, it'll do it soon. When I fill out this extent, at that point I do an allocation bitmap operation, I find the next free extent, I start at the beginning of that extent, I start writing there. And now before, the story I told was, I was going to copy the files for one at a time. Well, not quite. I'm still going to treat this as a circular structure, but my unit of scavenging is now going to be extents. What I'm going to do is, either when I start to run out of storage, or when I notice that an extent has dropped below a certain utilization threshold. So if it drops below the threshold, what I want to do is recompact the extent. But I don't want to do this in place, because if I do it in place, I can make a mistake and I can scribble on the wrong thing. So the method for recompacting an extent is to basically take all of its data and just append it to the currently active extent. And if that forces me into a new extent, fine. Just copy it from. Pick up the old data. Don't make any changes to it. All we're trying to do is linearize it. Pick up the old files one at a time, write them linearly at the end of the current extent. That's it. When you copy all the files, you can drop the old extent because they're no longer referenced because they've all been copied to the front. And the trick is basically to make sure there's a couple of extent gap between you and the end of the world, viewed in this cyclical fashion. And in fact, that gap doesn't even have to be contiguous if you're a little careful about this. It's okay to process the extents out of order. If I have one free somewhere, I can use it. That's cute. This file system is very efficient for writes. It's pretty efficient for reads. And in practice, it works very well for normal workloads. It's called the Log Structured File System, or LFS. And it was originally done by somebody named John Osterhout. And a later similar version was done by Margot Seltzer. And there's some controversy about the performance of these file systems. In fact, there's an infamous back and forth between these two people, each claiming that the other doesn't understand their own work. Now, this story works really well if I've got spare bandwidth capacity on average, viewed over a long time. Right? If the pattern is I work during the day, I go home at night, this is your friend. I can reorder at night. Where this is going to break down is when the disk starts to become very full, because it gets progressively harder to keep that guard region available. It's also hard in a more conventional file system design. What the rule of thumb is, when you hit 85% capacity of the disk, nothing you do will help. You just can't linearize the files anymore. You just can't find the right blocks in the right places to do it. The more interesting question for LFS, though, is what is the utilization of my bandwidth between the machine and the drive? If I'm using 100% of the bandwidth to move data, I don't have any spare bandwidth to reorganize the drive, do I? If that is 100% of bandwidth over a long time, like a big database machine, this is not your file system. If I have some, bursty behavior, active use, passive, passive non-use, right? Really, really hot active use, maybe I'm only using 50%, sometimes I do nothing. Now I've got some room to maneuver, I've got some background work to reorganize, right? I can restructure the file system on the fly. And then this is a very interesting file system because I get the benefit of the transaction stuff. Do you ever watch the battery? Someplace when you were very near to a power plug, okay, and you got a reasonably full battery to start with, pull the plug out of your laptop, right, and don't tell Unix you're doing it, and hold the off button down for 10 seconds, which is what it takes to get it to just power down forcefully. Power it back up. Okay. Watch. Most laptops will tell you the battery level on the way up somewhere. Look at the difference between the battery level on the way up and the battery level by the time it's done checking your file systems. It's awesome. I've seen it be as much as 15-20% of your battery. And it's all, it's been head rushing, man. It's got to get power from somewhere. The reason EXT3 was a big win for laptop users is EXT3 is a log structured file system. It's not using this log structure, it works very differently. But a lot of the ideas came from here.
Is EXT for extent?
Excuse me?
Is EXT for extent?
Yes. Yeah. And so what EXT does is instead of doing that traditional file structure over a very large file system, it does that file structure over extent. So each extent has an IMAP table. That lets it shrink a bunch of the data structures. And then off on the side, it has what they call a journal. And the way it goes about its writes is it writes the data directly to the stage storage, but it writes the metadata to the journal. And it does a commit record over in the journal. And only after the commit's been done does it copy the data into its official location. So when EXT3 comes up, the only thing it has to do is check the journal and decide what to throw out. And there's several different modes. You can run the EXT3 in everything goes through the log. You can run it metadata only through the log. You can run it, no, I'll take my chances. You can unmount an EXT3 file system, which causes the log to flush, and remount it as an EXT2 system, which is one of its very cool bugs. When EXT3 came out, the forward conversion to turn on the log, there was one command you had to run to create the journal file. That was it. And that meant that a whole bunch of tools that already knew about EXT2, like your bootloader, which really doesn't want to have to know about the log, basically didn't require any modification. Now, the argument for LFS is we're converting temporal locality into spatial locality. We're going to take advantage of the fact that all the writes associated with a file tend to come together. And by doing them linearly, we're just going to reflect that directly. So in fact, I've simplified the story. It's not the case that LFS linearizes the file. It's the case that LFS linearizes the writes that are associated with a given BD flush run. And all of those writes tend to end up in the same extent. And the extent size is chosen so that simply reading an extent at a time is just not that bad. And the problem at the level that your PC sees it is then just selecting the blocks that it wants. Now, in fact, it's not that LFS scrambles the bits either. It actually does try to organize things so that blocks associated with the same file will be written contiguously, right? But it doesn't kill itself to get there. So, right? Here's the potential locality for placement. It doesn't change over time. But the swap area plus the design in LFS gives me some temporal locality. And notice that all of the real I/O in my system, right, is happening in here. These are the frequently accessed right now files. And that's what I really want. Most recently written files in LFS, they're very near the disk head because the head is right where we left it. And since those files are disproportionately active, the head tends to stay there. But there is a further optimization possible, and I don't know that it's been tried in Unix possible. It's been tried in other systems, and there's an open question how well it would generalize. Suppose what I did, in fact, I know it wouldn't be normal. I want to give you the idea, because tomorrow I'm going to talk about a completely different system, which doesn't use any of these structures. It uses something very close to what I'm about to tell you. And because the I/O behavior of that system is different, this design works very well. Suppose what I did was that I have my memory, I always write to a journal area, and I write a log. And I'm going to two journal areas, or I'm going to use it circularly. I'm going to write a log record. After the log record is written, then what I'm going to do is migrate the data to its official location. So I'm still doing all the placement stuff. And when I read, the rule is if there's a newer version in the journal, read it there. Failing that, go back to the official data area and read it there. And I'm going to pick my journal area so that I can keep a directory of what's in the journal. The directory fits in memory. The journal's not all that big. Here's the tricky part. If a file is deleted before I migrate it, I don't have to migrate. Even if I haven't committed the delete. Because there's two scenarios. Either the commit will fail, in which case the files in the log are good, and I'll migrate it then. Or I've deleted the file, and the commit will succeed. In which case the file's been deleted, and if the commit succeeds, then anything I would have copied to the data area is now gone. Now, if you think the lifetime of most files is short, it's going to cut your I/O overhead a lot because the high frequency I/Os are going to this very narrow region of the disk, like 85% of them. And it's only those files that make it out of infant mortality that cause you to do long seeks. I got to stop. I actually ran longer than I intended. My apologies. Two things to think about for tomorrow. One, ponder this. Second, think overnight. Suppose I impose the rule that I was always going to write stuff to currently free blocks. So I'm never going to overwrite a block in place. How might that help? Think about that overnight.